Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Lingwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share that love with others. As we do each week, I'd like to begin our program with a story that is based on faith and form with imagination. If you were listening last week when we were in open conversation, I told this story, not thinking about the guests we would have tonight, but I think this story fits best what our discussion will be like this evening. While Jesus was alone in the desert, and after he had fasted for many months, a storm arose. He cried out to his Father, "Why have you led me here and expose me to this danger?" A voice within him answered, "I am here within you." Jesus replied, "But I do not see you." The Heavenly Father formed a circle of fire around Jesus. The flames whipped by the wind seemed to reach to the sky. Again, Jesus cried out and said, "You're frightening me. I'm afraid that the fire will consume me." And again, a voice within him said, "I am here within you." Then rain began to fall. It too surrounded Jesus, but did not touch him. Jesus cried out, "Father, Father, have mercy on me. Am I not your son?" The voice within him answered, "Have the winds licked at you? Has the water consumed you? Has the fire touched you?" Jesus cried out, "No, but I am frightened and alone." An angel appeared to Jesus, walking through the wind, the fire, and finally through the water. When the angel reached him, Jesus was still filled with fear, but there were no tears in his eyes. The angel said, "Son of the Most High, shed but one tear for me." And a tear came. Then the angel said, "Let me feel your heart." And his heart was exposed. "Let me touch your hand," the angel asked. And Jesus extended it. The angel said to Jesus, "You were not afraid to give me these three gifts given to you by your Father. Now walk with me." And she led him through the water, which touched him, but did not overwhelm him, through the flames which did not burn him, and through the winds which did not sting him. Jesus fell down upon his knees and cried out, "Father, I am loved." Again an inner voice said to him, "You have lacked faith, but fear not, even though fear is more consuming than these three great forces of nature. Stand up and be strong. Even the evil one is more fearsome than these three. He cannot be seen, but I tell you this. If you are not strong and filled with faith in the face of fear, if you are not compassionate where there is suffering, if you do not love where there is hatred, these elements of the earth will overwhelm you." Jesus cried out, "Father, I am only human." The Father extended his hands toward Jesus, and Jesus felt his love. Again, Jesus cried out, "I am loved." The Father within answered, "All men and all of creation are mine. They are to be loved, cared for, and must one day return to me. You, my son, must share your love through your words and actions." As Jesus stood and watched, the storm consumed the fire, and all was washed clean by the water. He said to the angel, "Where has it all gone?" The angel sat down. A tear began to form in her eye, and she said, "This is the tear you gave to me. This is the heart, and this is the hand you gave to me. I give them back to you, and they shall be remembered until the end of time. Your tears will intermingle with the tears of many others. Your heart shall bleed and give love to many, and your hand shall be a source of comfort and strength to many." Jesus looked into the heavens and cried out, "Father, I am your son. Give me the words to speak your truths. Give me the strength to do your will. Give me your love so that I may endure all that I must experience." A page was turned in the life of Jesus, and he knew that he was truly the Son of God. A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the first chapter of her first book titled When Spirit Calls, A Healing Odyssey. I walked into the empty sanctuary at Boston University and followed my parents to our usual seats in the second pew in front of the pulpit. BU's Marsh Chapel was steeped in Methodist tradition. The man we had come to hear was not. Reverend Howard Thurman had received a chilly reception when he arrived in 1953 to be dean of the chapel, the first black dean at this or any other predominantly white university. Howard Thurman defied easy labels. Brought up Baptist, he was as much a Quaker. Although the grandson of a slave and shaped by the segregationist South, he was a messenger of hope who sought common ground. Imploring all people to open their hearts to each other, he inspired civil rights leaders to be nonviolent. Life magazine hailed him as one of the top 12 preachers in America. Martin Luther King Jr. named him one of the 10 most influential persons of the 20th century. Some called him a mystic. My father called him brother. To me, he became Uncle Howard. Dean Thurman welcomed people of all faiths and traditions to Marsh Chapel. His words on the front of the Sunday bulletin promised that the service would, quote, not seek to undermine the religious context, which gives meaning and richness to your particular life, but would rather address itself to the deepest needs and aspirations of the human spirit, close quote. Hundreds of blacks and whites, young and old, students and Bostonians would accept his invitation that morning. As I waited for the service to begin, I became immersed in Thurman's printed meditation. How good it is to center down, to sit quietly and see one's self pass by. The streets of our minds seethe with endless traffic. Our spirits resound with clashings, with noisy silences, while something deep within hungers and thirsts for the still moment and the resting lull. I sat for a while in stillness, then opened my eyes to find Jesus beckoning from the carved wooden altarpiece. My gaze drifted up to the rose window above, where the sun illumined Christ the teacher in his stained glass reds and whites and blues. He was seated in open embrace of the world, and I thought of little me. In him, I centered down. The centering mood was never broken, not by the choir's quiet entrance, the opening hymn, or the responsive reading. Even the collection plates disappeared. Soon, we were readying our spirits for the pastor's sermon and spoken meditation. As Boston Hyams Foundation's first executive director, Joan Diver, was nationally recognized for her creative leadership, a student of diverse spiritual paths, as we will learn this evening, and a speaker from the heart. Joan has since offered healing to seekers, led church ministries, and partnered with her husband, Colin, in his role as president of Reed College. Their urban story is chronicled in the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Common Ground, A Turbulent Decade in the Lives of Three American Families, written by J. Anthony Lucas. Joan Diver, welcome to Amplify.
Thank you. Thank you for reading that passage.
You are sure welcome. Tell us a little bit more about, because he appears throughout your book, about Uncle Howard, as you call him, and the influence he had on your life.
Well, it was quite extraordinary, and I think we often realize how great an influence is as we look back over time. I first met him when I was 9 years old in his congregation at Boston University. And I started going there regularly after I decided that I would not join my own congregational church because Howard Thurman spoke to my heart. So pretty regularly from the time I was 12 until I was married by him in 1965. So I just remember, even in those early, early days of my growing up, how he spoke about the inner spiritual life and how he spoke about the separation in our society, in our world, but always talked about it from such a universal sense that we were all connected, that the most important thing was love, and that we needed to keep the door of our hearts open no matter how many doors were closed against us. Mm-hmm. And this has stayed with me all these years. And the sense he gave that God rested within us was the thing that I carried forward most, I think, throughout my life. But there were so many places when I see that, when I started doing healing work, the ways he talked about how we're all connected, you know, how we can bring healing, this common consciousness that we share. He was just a wonderful human being. You know, I knew that he had mystic experiences. That was the well from which he drew this incredible understanding that he had. But, you know, he loved going to baseball games. And I can remember him sitting in my living room just, you know, laughing with my dad. So many ways. And I really carry him forward in my life. Yes. He, as you said, embraced people from all traditions. And so have I. And I pursued different traditions and found the common threads that run among them.
Right, and as he had mystic experiences, so too have you, and we'll talk about some of them tonight. And he said the rule of God is within, and that's where you knew you wanted to go. Through all of your experience, you're still a member of an Episcopal church, at least at the time of the writing of the book.
Yes, I am at the current time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I wasn't for a long time.
Right. How is it that you conceive God? When someone asks you, who is God, how would you answer that after your very rich experience?
Well, I understand God as a universal life force. I don't personify God in the way that some people do, although I understand that understanding, that we all have to approach God and understand it in our own way. But I really understand God as something that is in all of us, in everything, that we carry God within us, that it's, for me, God is not the judgmental king that we sometimes hear about. God is love. God is at the heart of it, love, and is in everything, in my view. So, I could go on.
No, God is love. No, you and I would certainly agree there. In the early part of the book, you talk about living in a struggling urban neighborhood where there was much crime. Eventually, you had to leave, and you hated so much to move out of the poor neighborhood into the suburbs. And you explain it felt like you were abandoning your friends and dreams. But because of that experience, you became the third family in a Pulitzer Prize book. Because the author was drawn to the conflicts that you had where you had lived, first of all, and your love for the city. Tell us a little bit about that story that is in the Pulitzer Prize book.
Well, you're correct. It talks about our struggles, our living in the city, our leaving the city. That's what drew him to us. The book is the story of three families in Boston, a poor Irish family, an African American family that's living in subsidized housing, as it turns out, right down the end of the street where we ourselves lived. And Tony very skillfully writes about each family's background as well as the way their lives intersected during the desegregation years in Boston. And he tells each story without judgment. And it was a great lesson to read his book, that each point of view, each story had its validity, and each family was important. So our story was that of being very active in the city, being very active to help improve our neighborhood, to develop community, to support the already integrated school that ended up being very badly affected by the desegregation plan. And we decided at a certain point when my husband found himself defending people out on the street and actually caught up with a mugger and hit him over the head, that that was just really too much.
Yes.
And that he wasn't sure he could live this way. He didn't think he could. He was afraid he might really hurt somebody. And this was a real problem because, you know, we wanted very much to live out our dream of people living together and living a common life, building community together. And we had done that, and we had worked hard at it, and we had loved doing it. And we still look at those days as some of the happiest of our lives. But there was a point where we really had to leave. And that was really a call. You know, I look at it now as a call that I did not want to leave there. But Tony Lucas, I don't think, would ever have written the story the way he did if we had not left and he had not found us and we had not agreed, I myself somewhat unwillingly.
We're going to take a short break. One of Thurman's quotes, he always talked about race in a way that drew upon the universal experience and how we should deal with people, how we should see ourselves. No matter the circumstance, we must learn to love, to transcend the walls that divide and discover our connection with every other being and also with God. We all belong to each other, he'd say. He had mined this understanding from the depths of his mystic spirit. We're going to take this break. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Joan Diver. We're talking about her book, When Spirit Calls, subtitled A Healing Odyssey. A healing odyssey because she had a great deal of pain in her life, and it would go and return, and she wondered if she was becoming the pain, and it led her to ask the question, who am I, from an acupuncturist. She learns that she has a gallstone. Pieces of disc, she finds out, also were trapped under her nerves. And then she goes to a trip to China, knew she wanted to go to a Buddhist temple. A temple had stirred her soul, and she begins to crave God's guidance in every moment of her life. Tell us a little bit then about your trip to China.
China was an extraordinary experience. It was really the first time I went off by my own. And I saw things that I never thought I would. It was a trip led by someone I knew. It was an invitation trip in 1984, before China was really as open as it is today. And we spent a week in a small village to the south, in the south of China, before going to Guilin, where I discovered that temple. In southern China, it was very rustic conditions, and we walked every day to a place to eat breakfast in the center of the village. And one day, the children were lining the street, and I wondered what the heck was going on. And what I learned was that there was going to be a parade of people being led to their execution. And this, of course, was shocking, but this is where I was. This is where I'd been led. And so it was really an extraordinary experience of connecting with the men, particularly, who were standing at the front of each of these trucks that went by, and connecting to them in some personal way, in some universal way, I would say. Mm-hmm. And we ended up being whisked out of town and sent off to a village on the coast. And so we were somewhat threatened. We weren't sure if we could stay in the country. Our films had been confiscated. So at one end of the spectrum in China, there was that kind of experience. On the other end, because of my back, I chose not to go to Beijing, where it was very cold in January. I chose to go to Guilin with one other in the group. And I happened to see a guidebook that talked about this destroyed temple out of town. And I went there and had to really convince the guide to let us see it, because it had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. And all I can say is that something resonated so deep in my soul that I just broke down and cried in that place. And it made me wonder, have I been here before? What is it that's speaking to me? Is it the pain of the situation? But I felt very, very connected to this place. Mm-hmm. The other thing that happened in China is I got to visit a hospital and to see patients who were being treated with acupuncture. Again, the conditions in the hospital were very, very basic, but people were being cared for. They were being cured by means that at that time were not that common at home. So to me, it was an eye-opening experience, and something happened to me personally that broke me open in some way. And I can't explain how or why or mm-hmm. which particular experience did that, but I came home with a new sense of myself, a new sense of what I wanted to do at that particular time with the foundation that I was running. And so it was just extraordinary, open to a new world with all its pain, but yet feeling connected in some very deep way to those who were suffering and to those places where that pain had occurred.
Most people probably, when they crave God's guidance in every moment of their life, probably look deeper into their own religious tradition. But because of the experience that you just shared with us, you felt drawn to other forms of spirituality, and you visit a guru and repeated the mantra, which meant I bow to the divine self within, which related to Howard Thurman's words, the rule of God is within.
Yeah.
And you believe
yeah.
that this guru awakened your divine energy and your whole life began to change, believing that it can only be given by a perfected being who sees God in every person and thing. And at this point, your husband is a little doubtful. The hard lesson was surrender. You always get what you need, and you experience the unraveling of the mystery of the spirit. Unconscious uh-huh. memories are unlocked within you, and mm-hmm. you begin to acknowledge that there are those who can know everything about us, and they are mm-hmm. plain and ordinary, but they are indeed enlightened beings among us. Why then did you expect your life to change?
Well, it is said, you know, in that particular tradition, that your whole life will change because you're opened up in some new way. And I had thought my life was just fine, thank you very much, the way it was. And I did question the only part of the tradition, saying that only the master could open you up in this way and open up this new energy. But once it started to happen and I got deeper to that place within myself, I had to be open to the possibility that, yes, indeed, things could change. And I couldn't know how, and I couldn't know exactly what was going to happen. I had already, through some healing experiences, I had had experienced some pretty significant changes as well. So I just felt like this spiritual path was opening me up more and more and more and more. And what's interesting with the experience in the ashram, it was after I was in the ashram for the first time that year. The following year is when I rediscovered the Episcopal Church. And so part of the opening was going into another tradition and discovering a new language and then saying, oh, is that what people are talking about?
Yes.
And seeing the common threads, as you say, Howard Thurman talking about the rule of God within and how we all belong to each other, and we must be still to listen to the voice of God. These are all things that were being talked about in the ashram. And not necessarily so obviously in church, but nevertheless, that's all there in our tradition, as you know. So being in the ashram was extraordinary. I know I would not be who I am today if I hadn't had that experience.
How can love be divine? You grew to believe that pain can be divine.
Why is love divine? Is that what you said?
How can pain be divine?
How can pain?
Yes.
How can pain be divine? Well, it's a wonderful question. And the way I can understand it is that pain can lead you to God.
Yes.
It is an instrument, shall we say, a vehicle for our being transported to new understanding, to new awareness, and to new experience. Again, Howard Thurman, who you've quoted so well, says, suffering is where God knows right where to find you. And yes. After I had gone through some enormous pain, I listened to a tape where he said that. And I thought, that is absolutely true. Because it was going into the heart of the pain that I found myself saying the mantra and praying so hard and just all these words coming to me, Hail Marys, from all different traditions that I might have experienced. And I realized that I had a divine experience. And it was beyond, in my case, it was beyond something that surgery could do. It was like a surgery that was happening to me. And I felt that it was happening by some universal energy, if you want to call it God or consciousness, mm-hmm. whatever. It was happening to me. And it was happening, in fact, so that I could open up to a whole new level of energy within myself that I could then share with others. And so it was an extremely profound experience for me. And I didn't recover for quite a while. But when I did, I could look back, and even while I was having the experience, I knew that was a spiritual experience.
Right. Reading from your book, The Great Love is Not Bound by Conditions. I would have to let it come on its own mm-hmm. terms. I'd have to be willing to be killed. Only then could my fear be vanquished. And mm-hmm. then from the guru, once upon a time, our life story began with God exists, and so do we. All were one with God. Then the mm-hmm. separation began, bit by bit, until finally there was complete separation. It became this and that. We had lost understanding of our divine connection. And so many ways we're trying to recover that in terms of how God is love. And it's at this point that your husband finds loving peace within him. So he didn't remain suspect of what it is that you were doing. You refer to the Mayan calendar. Let me just tell you an interesting story. I think you would probably be interesting. Back in 2012, the man who was in charge of the Mayan calendar came to Pittsburgh. He was drawn here, wasn't invited. The Spirit brought him here, and he came to indicate something that he felt he needed to reveal was that Pittsburgh is one of the great spiritual centers of God's energy in the world. And I could go a lot beyond that, and it's placed under the Milky Way. And he brought the grandmothers, the Mayan grandmothers here, who maintain the tradition. There is a connection, I just want to say, between the Mayan calendar and Pittsburgh.
Oh, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. Thank you.
There's a whole lot more about that. And then you had a walk with Jesus. You questioned if Jesus could revive the dead. Why not me? Why not us? And you visit the Holy Sepulchre, and you believe that the vibrations of Christ's faith were transferred into your being. And I would even say that in another way, in terms of God's grace, that as I'm involved in certain things. Tell us a little bit about that visit to the Holy Sepulchre.
It was a totally guided experience. I was there with in Israel with a group of women leaders from Boston on a trip supported by the Jewish Community Relations Council here. And so it's primarily a social political trip, but they very kindly took us to all the sites, or to many of the sites, I should say, where Jesus walked. However, when we first arrived in Jerusalem, there was something that moved in me that I had to get to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The group had not gone there yet because we had just arrived. And I literally got off the bus and registered in the hotel and walked out the door by myself. And we had been warned not to do that because it was the first intifada, and that was not the safest thing to do. And I didn't know exactly where to go, but I had seen where the bus had passed by the old city of Jerusalem. And so I walked in that direction, and I just kind of followed my nose and let myself be led, and led into one of the gates of the old city of Jerusalem, and it's very narrow ways with overhangs, all strange to me. I just followed wherever I was led, and I actually ended up at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which was in itself a miracle. And when I got there, there was only a group of people chanting, and so I stepped aside, and they continued, and then I walked around the church, and I came back. And when I did, they were all gone. And in the center of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, there is a structure that is thought to be the place where the tomb of Jesus was. And so I entered that space, and I got down on my knees, and I started to pray, and I just started to vibrate. Mm-hmm. And my mouth changed, and I went through this series of things that were really involuntary. And I realized I was just being infused with this energy, and with great gratitude, and as you say, enormous grace, that I would be led there, that would happen, that it could happen. And then I walked home alone in the dark and to the hotel. And when I got there, everyone was having dinner. And I walked into the room and I sat down. And my friends on the trip looked at me and said, "You look like you know something we don't. Mm. Something has happened to you." And I just smiled. and, you know, went on with my dinner. So it was a very, grace-filled experience. It's really even hard to explain. It's almost hard to talk about. But it did happen, and I have such gratitude, because you don't go to the Church of Holy Sepulchre and find it empty. That just doesn't happen. There's usually crowds roaming around and screaming and yelling. And when our group did go there in the end, there were M16 rifles piled up in the front of the plaza because a group of soldiers had gone in. So my experience was really one of being led and being given that great gift. And I'm grateful to this day.
Yes. By a woman by the name of Shyla, a healer, reveals to you about the workings of the Holy Spirit within us, and indicates that you too could become a healer, and you realize at that point that you are being called to help people open their hearts, and each of us has to open our own in a sense. And is healing something then that has been a part of your life? You helped to heal your husband's ankle, so right there we know that something new happened in your life.
I found myself, after going to healers myself and having some of these experiences that we've been discussing, I found that people were just getting sick or hurting themselves in my presence. And this was while I was running a foundation in Boston, one of the largest foundations in Massachusetts at the time. And so this was kind of, I was living two lives, if you will. And my assistant had a kidney stone attack at home, and she asked me to come. And the newspaper vendor collapsed in my presence while I was buying a newspaper on the street. And there were just a whole series of these things that happened. And I realized that I was just being led to see that the power of healing and healing hands. And ultimately, I started to feel that if I ever were to leave the foundation, as you suggested, what I wanted to do was to help people open their hearts. And in the same way that I was hoping to open mine. And so my antenna, I suppose, were up for that. But it was just a wild thought, because after all, I ran a foundation and I was on all these boards and, you know, I did all these things in the world. And then an opportunity came for me to do a training in a particular form of healing that helped people to connect with the divine within themselves and to have it access experiences that otherwise got in the way of their experiencing that love that they hold inside. Howard Thurman had said that we need to really work at getting rid of whatever stands between us and our total exposure to God's love. And that's what I felt the spiritual healing work was doing. This was at a, you know, different, it was different than coming at it from just a physical level, but going deep into the heart and soul. And so I did that work for a number of years, and then I was called to be director of contemplative and healing ministries at an Episcopal church in Philadelphia, St. Paul's Jesuit Hill. And so I did that, and I've been involved in different church healing ministries, and I've had a small group of clients I see on the side, and I don't do the extensive work that I did long ago, but I do see people and do energy work with them.
Again, you have to participate in the experience of God to discover the possible you. How were you able to handle the switch between Eastern and Western spiritualities, because they can be so utterly different? What did you learn from the fact that you were drawing from both of these traditions. We just have about 2 minutes, and we're going to take a break.
Okay. So I would just say quickly that what I've learned in this journey is how everything is really one, and that everything is connected. So the more that, you know, we talk about our separation from God and how we work at that, well, how do we work at that through our lives? So to the degree that I can help bring things together and see the unifying aspects and the common ground in different traditions, that's what I'm drawn to.
And of course, there's so much that we say today that there's been this great division between religion and science. And yet, mm-hmm. if we're really open to it, we discover there's so much, there's a really deep relationship between the two. And science is really revealing a lot of things to us about God or about God's creation mm-hmm. and presenting in a particular way. But we need then interpreters, people who can look at it and bring about that union between the two. And as we go to the break, I want to point out, we haven't talked too much about the foundation. You've mentioned it, but through your efforts, the foundation helped to stabilize 10 struggling community development corporations mm-hmm. with development grants of $4.5 million. So we're going to take this break, and we'll be back to continue our discussion with Joan Diver about when the Spirit calls. And when we come back, we're going to ask her why she decided to go to Egypt. We're on break. Welcome back to Amplify. I'm going to reestablish a program for you. Our guest this evening is Joan Diver. She has written a book titled When Spirit Calls, A Healing Odyssey. And she was the first executive director at a large foundation in Boston, was nationally recognized for her creative leadership. She's a student of diverse spiritual paths, as we've learned, and more to learn during this hour, and a speaker from the heart, as we've heard. And she has since offered healing to seekers and led church ministries and partnered with her husband when he was president of Reed College. Joan, as we ended the first hour, I indicated that when we came back, I was going to ask you the question about why you decided to go to Egypt.
Uh-huh. So that was really an extraordinary call. You know, sometimes our decisions are made for us in a way. And I had heard about this meditation journey to Egypt, and I thought it was going to be at Christmas time, and I couldn't possibly go then. And I had been in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and had been with a healer out there and had learned about something she was planning to do in the future related to healing. And I went home, and somebody called me and said, gee, have you heard about this trip to Egypt? It's going to be in February. And he started reading what was going to happen there. And it just seemed like such an extraordinary thing that we would be connecting with the wisdom of the ancient ones, and we would be going to Mount Sinai, and we'd be going to all the temples along the Nile. And something just rose up within me. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And so I went to work the next day, and I'm thinking about Egypt the whole day. And when I get home that evening, there's a package waiting for me in the mail. And the package has the brochure for this very same trip. And it's from my friend Shyla, whom you mentioned earlier in the broadcast. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I am being called to Egypt. I just got home from Santa Fe. When Colin came home, I said, Colin, I think I have to go to Egypt in February. And so the decision was just something that rose up in me as all these synchronicities came together within 2 days. And I knew I had to go, and I did.
And what is it that happened there? At one point, you wondered if there was something that you should know to direct your life. But you were asking that question a lot, weren't you?
Yes. Yes, I was. This trip, though, it seemed that we were following the path of ancient priests and priestesses. So, again, I've entered into another tradition I really, in this case, knew nothing about. But it was very ritualistic. And there were certain temples or areas where very specifically it was about hearing your call. You know, priests and priestesses were doing that. They were following a path. They wondered if they should be on this journey. They would receive various wisdom at various sites. So the last day, as you said, you know, I'd been asking this question as we went along. And the last day of the trip, we enter the Great Pyramid of Giza at sunrise, and we climb up this very dusty passageway up into the king's chamber. And we form a circle, and at the end of the room, there is a sarcophagus, and it's an open sarcophagus, has no cover, and we're sitting in a circle on the ground, and each of us has a turn in the sarcophagus. And it comes to my turn. We each have 3 minutes, and I climb in thinking that, you know, I'm going to get this guidance from on high. And what happens for me is that it stirs something inside, and I make a commitment. And the commitment is, I will go forth in thy service with full faith and trust, and I will do it. I-T.
Yeah, capitalize. You capitalize that. What
capitalized.
What do you mean by it capitalized?
What I mean by that is, I don't know what it is.
Okay.
It is something that is out there. I don't know what it is, but I know that I'll be led there, just as I'll be led to the sarcophagus. And I had, heard about a possible training program and the spiritual healing that I discussed earlier. And I thought, well, maybe that's it, but, you know, I don't know. I don't even know if that's going to take place. When I went home, there was a sermon waiting for me in the mail that said, Dare You Be Transformed? And it was based on Transfiguration Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And it talked about scripture readings, you know, Moses on Mount Sinai, and the Transfiguration of Christ. And I had just been at the base of Mount Sinai at the Basilica of the Holy Transfiguration, and I had climbed to the top of Mount Sinai at sunrise. So I am shaking as I'm reading this. You mean that thing that I committed to in the sarcophagus? Dare I go forth? Oh, and then the sermon goes on to say, what about our lives? What about our careers? Dare you be transformed? Well, that did it. So I knew at that moment, even though I was still facing my fears, that I would have to resign from the foundation, and I would have to find out what it was.
Yes.
So I did.
Let's go back to Egypt for a second, because you speak about they who wanted to take you to the other side, and it's described as a struggle between life and death. Tell us about that experience.
Okay. So that was really an experience someone else had.
Oh, okay.
But I was very much part of it in that I noticed someone at dinner looking very ashen. And I spoke to the leader of our group, and she said, you know, she's not looking so well. The leader of the group said, well, you know, you think she needs healing. Why don't you and Shyla go? Shyla was on this trip. You and Shyla go and help her. And I really did not feel up to doing that. I, you know, hadn't done much healing at that point. So, but anyway, we did. And it just felt that this woman was losing her life force. And she would, her color would come back, and then she would recede. And then her color would come back, and she would recede. And so I just prayed that the leader of our group would come back. And as it turned out, without going through all the details, she did. And she did a healing. I was present for part of it, but I had to face my own fears about this. You know, I didn't know about, you know, people being drawn to the other side, that being death. We were near the Valley of the Kings and the Queens in outside Luxor, and their tombs were there. And it just turned out that what this person was experiencing, as she told me later, that she could see the sundial going toward her death. And if it reached a certain hour, she knew she'd be gone. And in fact, she was revived, obviously, because she told me the story. So, but what she felt coming from me, she told me, was this extraordinary love. And I said, I wasn't even in the room the whole time. And she said it didn't matter.
Yes.
And that was kind of an extraordinary learning for me, that how we can be so present to somebody in a situation like that. But I, you know, I kind of receded. So it was quite extraordinary. And when I was looking back at the book today, and I was seeing how we know that Jesus brought people back from the dead, and the disciples brought people back from the dead. And I had never made that connection with this person who wasn't dead, but she was so close to dead.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been dead, but she wasn't. So,
do you believe that there is
all a mystery? You know?
Right.
It's all a mystery.
Do you believe that there is an evil force in the world and throughout the world? Because you write also about dark energies.
Yes, I do write about dark energies. You know, and I'll be honest. This is something that I think it's I struggle with. Around the language, I feel that everything is connected, and it's all working together, and it's all unified. But, you know, there are forces that are leading what seems like in one direction, and then there are forces that are leading in another. And yet there's a way in which the breakdown, if you will, it's also allowing new creation. So, like everyone else on the planet, I struggle with, you know, how best to explain this. But for myself, I see everything working together in some way. And I think we use language to talk about evil and dark forces. Do I think that is totally separate? You know, I'm working at trying to bring everything together in unity and not having anything outside the circle.
You meditated on what you had to surrender and wondered where your new life was taking to you. Are you still engaged in those kinds of questions? Do you wonder where life has taken you at this point in your life? And you still have to meditate on what it's necessary for you to surrender.
That's a wonderful question. I feel where life has taken me, where it became this book, When Spirit Calls, The Healing Odyssey. And the journey of the book, the 24 years of this book, was a healing odyssey in itself. And so I think that there's been a lot of healing and surrender. And I don't wonder now, I think about, you know, what I need to surrender. I feel that I'm being called into this new role that I have, speaking with you, which is such an honor and a privilege, which I'm humbled to do, and to see the book out in the world and the way it's helping people. So what I had to do is surrender my life story, and not be afraid of it being out there in the public sphere. And that turned out to be a bigger surrender than I expected it to be. So, you know, there was emotional and physical trauma that went along with that as we got nearer to the publication date. But walking through that door, it's always about walking through the door and taking your fear with you. And then at some point, you know, letting go of it. So I don't worry about the surrender at this point. I feel I'll be led to surrender whatever it is I need to surrender, but to have whatever it is I need play is the wrong word, but to be in the role that God is asking me to do at this point in my life. And that's what I want to do. I just want to do whatever it is that is in alignment with mm-hmm. with God and my most inner divine self, and to bring love to the world and however I can do that. So I don't at this time worry that I'll have to leave my husband or I'll have to leave my life behind. I'm happy to, you know, face whatever might be asked of me, but I don't need to know what that might be.
What did you become when you became what is referred to as a spiritual warrior?
A spiritual warrior. Well, that's what I've been working on for a long time, since I was introduced to that concept in 1989. So it is about being able to speak your spiritual truth, to that, you know, can take a little courage. You've been doing this all your life, I assume. I don't know your whole life story, but I assume, given your priesthood. So it's about stepping into that and not being afraid of it or facing one's fear. You know, just like that story that you told at the beginning, Jesus had to face his fear. And we all need to do that and see, you know, what those fears are. Where are they coming from? How are they standing in the way of us and our connection with God? And just to become stronger and stronger. So in my case, my body, as it did in the book, tends to be a messenger. And it you know, it will break down. It will get sick. It'll do all kinds of things. And I've had to learn to be a warrior about my body, too, to let it do these things and to really ask it what it's trying to tell me, if there does seem to be a message, or maybe it's just asking me to be strong in spite of whatever physical limitation I might have in any given moment. But, it's about having the courage of the spiritual path and being willing to speak the truth and to follow where God is leading.
Yes, as you point out in the book, it's all about God's love. Your pain comes back to you, and you interpreted as meaning that God was preparing you for new work, and that it wasn't all physical, and you and it must be just a manner of speaking, but you indicate that the demon in you refused to give up, and that God was trying to teach you something through a car accident, that you were to allow God to work through you. Is that a decision you believe we all have to make, that we have to allow God to work through us?
I think we all have to be led, however, we feel led. And I can't judge how somebody else, how someone else is being led in their lives. Mm-hmm. I studied at Chestnut Hill College, that is run by the Sisters of St. Joseph in Philadelphia at one point. And one of the teachers, a nun, said something that I've stuck with me my whole life, and it is my whole life since, I mean, that nobody holds the whole picture. It's as if we all have these different roles. Now, what I do believe is that in order for us to have peace in the world, in order for us to come to some new place of the way we connect to the planet and connect to each other, that we really need to find that place inside that knows this, that knows this love, that knows that we are loved, that knows that we can give this love to each other, and that we are all connected. And this common consciousness, this God, is present for us. So I can't prejudge how someone else should be, but I can do my part to share my spiritual story so that perhaps other people will follow their own paths to healing and wholeness and have the courage to share their stories. I think people hide a lot of their stories. Well, people have stories, but they don't dare talk about them because people will think they're crazy.
Yes.
So I really do want to honor everybody's path, but I hope that somehow we can all come to this awareness.
You point out that at that point, oh, I'm sorry, I've missed a break here. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify, just about 18 minutes before we break. Our guest is Joan Diver. We're talking about her book, When Spirit Calls, A Healing Odyssey. She writes, I had come to believe more and more that God, as the life force of the universe, was present as comforter and creator, not only in everyone, but also in every experience, both painful and joyful. And the power and grace of God moving in us and with us created our challenges and choices, carrying us through. Joan, but with all your strong beliefs, you still had moments when you struggled to hold fast to your faith. Do you still have any of those struggles today?
My faith is very strong. I don't know quite how to answer that in an abstract since I feel really strong right now.
Sure, okay.
But I know that one faces fears. I think what happens with me is that when I get into a difficult place, I just seem to know that underneath all that is this very strong place of faith, and that whatever it is I am moving through, I will get to the other side. And when I get to the other side, I will be stronger and my faith will be stronger. And that I just have to keep moving through whatever, wherever I'm led, whatever new experiences and so forth. I think part of my faith is that I don't have a fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it hasn't been tested, but I don't have this lingering fear of death that I think can overshadow so much of our suffering. And so I have a much more optimistic view of my life and a lack of fear of losing it, that whatever I do here now is what I need to do here now. And I think that life will continue in some form. And so I do feel that I do have a very strong faith. And we'll see if yes. It gets tested. We know that it can. I'm open to that possibility.
You pray then that you might surrender to the will of God. I'm sure that's your prayer today. It's my prayer also. My spirituality is different than yours. But nevertheless, certainly we could pray together to surrender ourselves to the will of God. And you write that the greatest freedom we have is in transformation, that I must eliminate all my resistance to following God's call to wherever God takes us. Tell us about that resistance in following God's will and why prayer is needed to strengthen us in that effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I say it might take a lifetime. I think that in me this desire grew as I had more and more inner experiences of God's love and God's guidance. But the resistance would show up because I was being led into new places that I had not experienced before. And I had a certain image in the world. And it was clear that, you know, maybe something else was happening to me. And maybe I wasn't going to have that same image or whatever. So there's a lot to let go of. And so the prayer, and you're right, it happens more than once in the book, doesn't it?
Yes.
You know, really praying for that ability to move through the resistance. And the resistance is the holding on to the way, in my case, that I've been or that who I've been in the world, and not knowing, you know, what's ahead, and to keep hitting those places where I didn't know what lay ahead. So prayer, yes, prayer and openness and contemplation, being in a place of stillness. Howard Thurman used to say that we needed to be still, as in that centering down passage that you read earlier. We need to be still so that we can hear the voice of God. And it's hard if you have a busy life to find that quiet time. It takes discipline. And when I was with the foundation and I had children, I would meditate on the bus going to work, you know, and I would pray on airplanes. And I would, you know, there are different ways that we can open ourselves up to how we're being led and to move through that resistance.
It's very practical and really foundational. We're directed by the fact that I just need to do what I need to do, isn't it?
Right.
Whatever it is, I need to do what I need to do. And had to surrender everything, even the attachment to becoming free of hurt. How does one do that? There are a lot of people struggling with pain and are suffering. And some reach the point of addiction, others just is attraction. But how do you become free of hurt in your mind?
Well, the experience that you're talking about happened actually in India, and I just suddenly had this awareness. I had come there with a lot of pain that had grown out of a very spiritual experience of having my spine move spontaneously on its own. And I interpreted that as bringing in some kind of new energy for me. And I think at the same time, it did bring up quite a bit of resistance. And so when I went to India, I had been invited really with the possibility that I would be freed of the pain. Mm-hmm. And what I realized, I mean, major teaching of ashrams is about attachment and letting go of attachment and surrendering, as it is in the Christian tradition, but this is still something that's talked about every day. And so I realized that we can be attached to our attachments. And so for me to want to be free of the pain was, in fact, an attachment. And so I really needed to let go of that idea that I would be healed. Mm-hmm. I had to just let go of it and just to let it happen whenever it was going to happen. And if I went home and still had the pain, so be it. And what was interesting in that experience was that the pain did let go of me. When I let go of my attachment to letting go of the pain, shortly thereafter, it was freed. And how do we explain that? How do we explain that? So there's something very powerful in surrender. I wasn't doing it with the intention of, okay, you know, well, if I surrender this, you know, I'll be all better. No, it was just this, you know, almost this painful awareness that, gee whiz, I have to let go of this too. So I can't do that for other people, but I can say that over the years since then, and it isn't always easy, but I realize now that I am much better at allowing whatever it is and allowing it to pass through. And I think that, in fact, that it passes through more quickly when we're able to do that.
You sound like you have learned to live with mystery. Mystery can have a small M, or mystery could have a capital M, which would be referring to God, but that's part of what life is about, isn't it? Learning to live with mystery.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And seeing it everywhere you turn. If you look up from your iPhone, you know,
yes.
It's there in every little thing to be seen, if we will only look.
And so you had to surrender everything, even the attachment to becoming free of the hurt you were feeling, and you were told the cause of your pain is the desire to make the impossible possible instead of enjoying the possible. Explain that for us, that we have to enjoy the possible.
Well, I think what it says to me is that if in this instance we're talking about the back pain at the moment, right? So
yes.
In that instance, what if it is impossible at the moment for that pain to go away? So the question becomes, how can I enjoy the possible, which is the situation that I'm in now? So, you know, it's like, you know, we have these desires. We want something to happen. It doesn't even have to be anything like that, you know, getting rid of pain. But we have this desire, whatever it is, for a thing or for, you know, something to manifest in our lives, and it doesn't happen. And it makes us suffer. You know, it makes us suffer. I see so many people suffer when something won't happen in their lives, and they can't have children, or this can't happen, or that can't happen, or the other thing can't happen. Well, what if we embraced what is happening rather than what isn't happening? And then would we suffer as much? That is the question. And I think that is the meaning of that quote that you just spoke.
And so the struggle for each and every one of us is to truly understand that God is our inner core, and we have to live our life for God. That's the great challenge in the end, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and isn't that something, that God is at our core, not outside, not, above, not that isn't above or below or around, but inside. Yes. And what if we all lived our lives in accordance with what we hear from that God inside? What if we all opened our hearts to one another? What if we followed that call? The world would be very different, wouldn't it?
I think it would be, no matter what your spirituality was. And even though our spiritualities, yours and mine, are different, there are places where they reflect one another, said in different words, expressed in different ways, understood from a different angle. And we began the book when part of your struggle was the fact that you were in such pain, but as it ends, you are healed, aren't you?
Yes. Yes.
More fully than perhaps most people can understand. And then your husband writes poems to you earlier in life, and little romantic poems, and he writes this one. I won't speak of love, but I can think of her face and a softness in her eyes. Or was it only a distant stare, a questioning glance? I can hold that soft look in her brown eyes that maybe wasn't there at all. And was it not rather on a rainy evening and cold that first I dared to dream her eyes were speaking to mine? Beautiful little poem. Our guest this evening, go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you.
Yes.
I'm very touched that you read that.
Our guest this evening has been Joan Diver. We've been talking about the book she's written, When Spirit Calls, A Healing Odyssey. Joan, thank you so very much for being with us and explaining how it is that you face life and how you've turned to many different spiritualities to find your way to God.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you for spending the time with us this evening. God bless you.
God bless you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
So we've come towards the end of the program. Let me read again a passage from the book, When Spirit Calls. And again, it's different. As I've said in the program, our spiritualities are different, but we need to know there are people like that in the world. And we need to understand that we are all children of God, and we've got to come to understand one another, and so that we can all come to the truth from the different perspectives by which we look at it. And she writes, I have discovered the art of healing. I've learned that much of our physical and emotional pain has causes that go well beyond dimensions with which we are familiar, that there are ways in which the fears and anxieties that hold us back can be lifted from us, that there is a flow to life that asks us to see ourselves as part of something bigger than ourselves, and that each of us is connected by a common bond that seeks the unity of all that is life. So again, we're looking for those bonds between us. And that bond, of course, is the bond of love. It's the bond of appreciation, where we come to know one another and respect one another even with differences. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone. And come back next Sunday and amplify with us.